Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
A week ago, Russians woke up to a tragedy that claimed the lives of 140 people. Gunmen opened fire inside a packed concert venue. Billboards around the city show the flickering candle with the caption, "During the most difficult trials, Russia has always become stronger. It will be the same now." Before the dust could settle, a blame game started.
Zelensky and his несвора свара.
Так, мова йде безумовно про сплановану підготовлену операцію російських спецслужб.
The two camps that exist, the anti-Putin one and the pro-Kremlin one, those two camps live in an absolutely parallel reality.
Two narratives powered by agendas, retrofitting emerging evidence and downplaying the sole claim of responsibility.
2023 was such a bad year for IS, a group that craves the limelight. They love being the center of attention. They don't want to fall off the news agenda. And Russia has that propaganda ring to it. You know, we managed to carry out an attack in Russia.
But what actually happened and who was really behind the attack was for many a secondary question. The atrocity became an opportunity to prove a point. In this episode, we track the narratives and the counter-narratives underpinned by generous doses of disinformation and the warning that are graphic descriptions of violence. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Crassy Twig, and this is the Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring, looking at the world through the lens of its media.
Радіо Тегран.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
조종 두 당 두 나라 최고 영도자 동지들께서는.
The events unfolding on Friday, the 22nd of March in Moscow, found our Russia media analyst Andrei Vladov watching how state media was covering the breaking news.
After the attack happened, you could see that Russian state media, especially all three most popular Russian TV channels, and all of them are pro-Kremlin, they were wondering what to do. So constantly on giving updates about the attack, but they didn't know how to interpret it.
Social media was ahead of the game. Many commentators started to point the finger of blame before any evidence had emerged. Our disinformation team was looking out for the first takes. Among them, Russia watcher Olga Robinson.
The allegations accusing Ukraine of being somehow involved in the attack appeared on the Telegram channels in Russia almost immediately after the first reports of the attack emerged. The first mention that we tracked in one of the pro-Kremlin blogs emerged within the same hour. And it had absolutely zero evidence. It just said that the terrorist territory of Ukraine needs to be destroyed. Within the next hour, we saw some pro-Kremlin bloggers suggest that attackers look like the people from North Caucasus that are fighting on the side of Ukraine, which means that they're probably curated and run by the Ukrainian military intelligence.
Then the official reactions started pouring in.
By early morning Saturday, you could see official sources like the spokeswoman for Russia's foreign ministry, Maria Zakharova. She said, "We have been used to these acts of terror because Ukraine has been committing acts of terror against Russia since 2014. A former president, Dmitry Medvedev, who threatened a very brutal response if Ukraine turned out to be the one to blame."
This is what Dmitry Medvedev wrote. We voiced up his Telegram post.
"No courts of investigations will help if force is not countered with force, and deaths with total execution of terrorists and repression against their families. If it's established that these are terrorists of the Kyiv regime, it's impossible to deal with them and their ideological inspirers differently. All of them must be found and mercilessly destroyed. Death for death.
The official reaction set the tone. And so the accusations multiplied online, paving the ground for a fake video aired on a federal TV channel.
The allegations were then again repeated by other pundits and other commentators. Then just a few hours later, we saw a fake clip emerge on NTV, which is a major Russian TV channel, showing allegedly a Ukrainian official taking responsibility for the attack.
Чи весело сьогодні в Москві? На мою думку, дуже весело. Хочеться вірити, що такі веселощі ми будемо.
We looked into this clip and it's fake. So essentially what the clip is a composite of two different interviews that were shown on Ukrainian television several days apart. Both of them predate the attack. And then the campaign escalated the next day when Vladimir Putin himself came out with an address and blamed Ukraine.
Все исполнители, организаторы и заказчики этого преступления понесут справедливое и неизбежное наказание.
Putin appeared 19 hours after the attack and said, all those who behind this terrible act will be punished. The perpetrators, the organizers, and he said the masterminds, those who ordered this.
Others have chipped in to explain this narrative to their audience. Here is the leader of Russia's Communist Party, Gennady Zyuganov, voiced up by a colleague.
Unfortunately, many of our citizens do not fully realize that the Anglo-Saxons and NATO are conducting a war to destroy the Russian people. This wild, absolutely disgusting, barbaric terrorist attack is a clear proof.
And a post from Sergei Markov, an advisor to the Kremlin, also voiced up by us.
It is most likely the terrorist attack was organized in Kyiv, but they found Muslim perpetrators in order to stir animosity and to ruin Russia's relations with the Islamic world.
Ukraine has from the very start strongly denied any connection to the Crocus Concert Hall attack.
У них завжди однакові методи, це вже було, і відірвані будинки були.
Here, President Zelensky talks about how Moscow is always blaming others and how President Putin turns everything to his personal advantage. Everything is absolutely predictable, Zelensky says.
Вони сюди, на українську землю, нагнали сотні тисяч терористів своїх.
Маргарита Малюкова from our Kyiv team can tell us more about what Ukraine made of this story.
On the day of the attack, the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry issued a statement where it categorically rejected any accusations that Ukraine was somehow involved in this attack. And furthermore, the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry blamed Russia for the attack. It said it was a planned provocation by the Kremlin, which was designed to boost mobilization in Russia and encourage more people to join the war against Ukraine.
Why do you think they have put so much effort into this denial?
I think in some way Ukraine was expecting this because oftentimes you hear false accusations against Ukraine by the Kremlin. The whole war against Ukraine was based on a false pretext, the pretext that there are these alleged Nazis in Ukraine who are oppressing the Russian minority. Back from the early days of the war, where Russian media claimed that Ukrainian nationalists crucified a child in Donbass, which was completely false. It was later proven false.
By now, the message had dropped. State media went full throttle. Andrew identified the moment all TV channels started singing from the same hymn sheet, when the so-called metodichka, or guidelines, are thought to have landed.
By looking at the behavior of state media, we think it landed sometime around Saturday morning or Saturday noon, because they had already clarified what the main line is. How do they explain this attack? They follow the same guidelines dictated by the Kremlin.
Around that time, the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the attack. It was taken with a large pinch of salt by Kremlin propagandists. Margarita Simonyan, who is editor-in-chief of RT, expressed her doubts on Telegram with a post we voiced up.
There were no suicide belts on the gulls. None of them intended to die. None of them were religious fanatics. ISIS was nowhere near them.
The accusations from Russian officials and media personalities did not stop.
very famous ultra-nationalist Russian philosopher called Alexander Dugin. He's known as Putin's brain. And actually, his, shall we say, anti-Western ultra-nationalist philosophy has become the dominant political ideology of Putin's Russia. So Dugin said, the investigation must decide who did this, but it fits in with what Ukraine has already been doing. These attacks on Russian border regions. So they were linking this already to Ukraine, saying, okay, the Islamists may have done it, but we know who was behind this. And then Putin came out several days later and he said, yes, Islamists did it, but the people who were behind this, we have questions. We want to know who ordered this.
3 days after the attack, President Putin too acknowledged that the Islamic State might actually be involved. Following the somewhat surprising claims by the group, which made many people wonder what was its grievance with Russia. Mina Alami is our jihadist media correspondent.
The claim came out a bit piecemeal in multiple statements. On the 23rd, they gave more detail, saying that 4 gunmen were involved, and initially they said they had all escaped. In terms of the motive, it gave us a bit more information, saying that this is part of IS's ongoing war against countries that are at war with Islam, according to IS. The following day, it slightly updated that motive and said it is revenge, and IS never forgets its revenge. We know that Russia is considered a key enemy for not just IS, but jihadists in general. Of course, the history in Afghanistan, the Chechen wars, but more recently, the military involvement of Russia in Syria. It could be, of course, Russia's crackdown on IS members in Russia, in the North Caucasus.
IS didn't specify which branch was behind the Crocus Hall attack, and that might have added more questions about its involvement in Moscow circles.
It has existing branches, one in Afghanistan, known as the Khorasan or the ISIS-K branch. And it's not new. It was set up in 2015. But recently, it's been in the news because of suspected external ambitions beyond South Asia, beyond Afghanistan, possibly even into Europe. And it also has a branch in Russia, but that is mostly active in southern Russian regions, Dagestan, Chechnya. The Caucasus branch, also set up in 2015, claimed around, so far, 25 attacks in Russia, mostly in the Caucasus.
What kind of attacks are we talking about?
Past attacks in Russia or in the Caucasus have mostly been against security forces, against police forces.
The days when the Islamic State group was constantly in the news are long gone. The group rarely grabs media attention these days, something it's been keen to change.
2023 was such a bad year for IS. Its attacks globally went down. It lost yet another leader. It had, you know, multiple senior commanders who were killed in Syria. It hadn't managed to carry out any of these big headline-making attacks. And IS is a group that craves the limelight. They love being the center of attention. They don't want to fall off the news agenda. So this year, 2024, they seem to be adamant to reverse their fortunes. And it started with a bang. It started with the attack in Iran that killed nearly 100 people, and now the attack in Russia. And these are two mighty countries, Iran and Russia, where the security apparatus is known to be very tight, where IS doesn't really have a support base or a very active presence. But their supporters captured that right away, and they said, this is IS's present to Putin on his re-election. Of course, the Russia has that propaganda ring to it. You know, we managed to carry out an attack in Russia.
Olga spotted another attempt at disinformation. Pictures of 4 men from the Caucasus, from Ingushetia, were paraded on social media as the perpetrators.
One of the first things we have to do whenever we unpick any claim is reverse image search. So that's like our go-to check. And there were images circulating allegedly of suspects that emerged on social media late on Friday. And one of my colleagues quite quickly found out that those same pictures emerged on social media a few weeks before in relation to a news story of some militants being killed. So it was completely unrelated to the attack on the Crocus Hall.
And it wasn't just statements. IS issued a video of the Crocus Hall attack, providing visual evidence of its hand in it.
It also released a video showing the attackers while they were in action, probably with body cams. And that was kind of as evidence of its involvement. So no other country or interest was involved. It was us. They digitally distorted the voice of the attackers as they were talking to each other. We ran the video by our Central Asian experts, and they managed to discern that the language spoken by the attackers in that video is Tajik. Just watching the video, it just struck me how the whole thing seemed abandoned. I mean, the video is horrible. It was just absolutely gruesome. But just the way they went in, it just seemed like civilians, the people there were just there to fend for themselves. They went in easily. And once, when they were there, they just didn't seem to be in a hurry. They didn't seem to be worried. They just went around, not rushing and shuffling around. That also was kind of raising suspicion. So is it a false flag?
The video did impress IS supporters at the time.
Looking at it from IS and its supporters, the first day, especially when IS said the attackers had fled, I mean, their images, even if we didn't see their faces, but footage and clips of them in social media, they were lionized by IS supporters. It was everywhere. It was on the posters. It was, you know, praising the attackers. This is such an important recruitment tool for IS to say, look, we did this big attack and the attackers escaped.
Talking about propaganda, what we're hearing from the Kremlin now is that they're trying to downplay the claim from the Islamic State group and saying, well, it's pointing the finger at the West in general, but also saying that the US and Israel created the Islamic State. Therefore, that's the source of all of this. What's your take on that?
These are not new accusations or narratives. It's such a big breach of security. It really undermines the ability of these governments, of these countries to protect people. So I think it has to be something other than just a militant group. So I think it could be a way to justify such attacks by saying, well, it's bigger than just a little group. It must be some intelligence agencies involved. It must be a bigger kind of involvement of some bigger powers. Because how else do you kind of then explain this really big breach and this big attack?
A similar logic is at the bottom of many major conspiracy theories, this idea that some invisible power behind the scenes is pulling the strings. For their part, IS are clear about who their enemy is.
The attack also seems to be in line with IS's leadership message, specifically about the Gaza war. It called on its followers all over the world, wherever they are based, members, branches, to carry out attacks, no matter how big or small, where they are based. This is part of a global and ongoing religious war between Muslims and non-Muslims. Even when it claimed the Moscow attack, the first thing it said about the targets, it wasn't the focus that they were Russians. The focus was they are Christians. And IS's narrative in the context of it's a religious war.
You are listening to The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring. Back to the issue of the supposed ethnicity of the attackers that our experts have picked upon. How did the news go down in Tajikistan? Our regional expert is Marufjon Ismatov.
After Russian media reported that Tajiks were involved in the attack, Tajikistan's foreign ministry issued a statement dismissing the reports. The ministry called it fake information. The ministry said the media should have a responsible attitude when reporting about Tajik citizens' alleged involvement in the incident. The Tajik Interior Ministry also issued a statement saying that two Tajik citizens, who some Russian media outlets said were suspected of carrying out the attack, were not involved in it. It said that the two citizens are now living in Tajikistan, and they had returned from Russia last autumn. Tajik President Emomali Rahmon, without mentioning the Tajik nationals' alleged involvement in the attack, described it as a shameful and terrible incident. He urged his nation to pay serious attention to the education of their children and save them from the influence of extremist and terrorist groups.
Tajik officials may not have acknowledged their compatriots' alleged involvement in this attack, But the Tajik connection with the Islamic State group is well known in the region.
During the emergence of the Islamic State, about 2,000 Tajik nationals had reportedly joined the militant group. Some of those who returned to Tajikistan were imprisoned or pardoned. Several hundreds of Tajik militants were killed and their wives and children remained there. The government repatriated 339 Tajik women and children. And still, there are fears that some Tajiks are still in Afghanistan joining the Islamic State's Khorasan province. And there is a potential threat from that group to the country.
There has been a lot of talk that ISK is largely made up of Central Asians. And out of that, Central Asians, the majority are Tajiks. We haven't been able to independently verify that. Because ISK is very active in Afghanistan, and the Taliban has said since last year that the overwhelming majority of ISK is made up of Tajiks, it seems the group has deliberately now stopped giving the names of their members. Usually IS would love that kind of attention, but it stopped attributing it to these branches, again, maybe deliberately, maybe doesn't want to restrict the travel and the movement of certain individuals. It is very easy for people from Central Asia to travel to Russia. In fact, they don't need a visa. They can go there and stay there for 3 months. And there's various incentives for Central Asians to come, money incentive payments, but also fast track to citizenship. So anyway, there's a lot of this encouragement to come and work or head to Russia.
Millions of Central Asians work in Russia. For many, it's the only way to support their families back home. Many do menial jobs and often face prejudice. And since the Crocus attack, there's been an increase in beatings and episodes of racism against them. The embassy of Tajikistan even warned its citizens not to leave their homes unless necessary.
According to some reports, rights activists received over 2,500 complaints from migrant workers staying in Russia over the past 2 days after the attack. Dislike of Central Asians are not new in Russia, and the attack is only expected to amplify it. Despite all this, Russia remains the main migration destination for workers from the region, mostly due to the existing visa-free travel arrangements and popularity of the Russian language. In case of Tajikistan, remittances from citizens working in Russia account for nearly half of its GDP.
The Islamic State's claim of responsibility for this attack didn't seem to fit Moscow's script. Andrew observed how the state media handled it.
It was sometimes completely ignored, and the focus was on Ukraine was to blame. And this is done because Putin or the Kremlin or the Russian authorities can use this as an excuse to tighten the screws and clamp down even harder on dissenting voices inside Russia. And also, many commentators say it is an excuse to rally support, even more support for the war in Ukraine and support for another mass mobilization campaign to send more people to fight. And another aspect of the tightening the screws thing is talk started among Russian MPs of bringing back the death penalty. President Putin can do that with a presidential decree.
We've seen how keen Moscow's been to blame Ukraine from the very start, a narrative out of step with the Islamic State group's repeated claims of responsibility. In the meantime, a counter-narrative emerged among critics of the Kremlin. This is Olga territory.
Yes, there is a counter-narrative that is very popular among opponents of Russian President Vladimir Putin, but also among kind of pro-Ukrainian circles. And the narrative is very simple, that Krakow City Hall was a false flag operation. So it's essentially a staged attack that was conducted by the Federal Security Services of Russia. It dates back to the very early days of Vladimir Putin's rule, because in 1999, there were suggestions and suspicions that the deadly apartment bombings in several Russian cities that essentially catapulted Putin into power and made him incredibly popular and turned him from an obscure personality into the national leader, that those were somehow staged by or carried out by the Federal Security Services. We still don't really know for sure whether that was the case, but those suspicions have existed for decades now. And essentially, what we are seeing is a continuation of that cycle. And people are constantly trying to find little kind of inconsistencies in the footage or anything, any little details to confirm kind of their suspicions.
This is a mainstream narrative in Ukraine as well, as Margarita observed.
Commentators are recalling the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings, which some say have been orchestrated by the FSB to justify the war in Chechnya. Quite a lot of people are bringing up this example and others to say this would not have been the first time that Russia might have used a provocation to justify further tightening up of screws and indeed launching further military action against another country or another nation. I think most agree that probably the Kremlin was somehow behind it, but it's not even really the main story in Ukraine right now because most are focusing on the war that's happening in the country and the Russian missile attacks. Some commentators say it's not even worth questioning who could have been behind it because for Ukraine, the outcome is still the same. There's a war going on and that's what should really be the focus of the media attention.
And it goes hand in hand with the theory as to how Russia might benefit from this. Olga again.
I guess the main idea behind the counter-narrative is that somehow the authorities need this attack to then mobilize more people to fight in Ukraine, to justify more repression following Vladimir Putin's re-election for another 6 years, or even just as an illustration or as proof of the allegation that Russia is a mafia state and it is run by criminals who don't really care about people's lives.
To recap, there's a claim of responsibility and two narratives, both downplaying or even ignoring the claim.
When the kind of unique situation where, as some observers have pointed out on Twitter, on X, that we essentially have two camps, and it's almost comical to see IS, the Islamic State, repeatedly try to claim responsibility and provide evidence repeatedly for them being involved in the attack, where the two camps that exist online, the anti-Putin one thinks that it's a false flag, it's the FSB who's to blame, and the pro-Kremlin one says it's Ukraine who's to blame. And those two camps live in an absolutely parallel reality.
While these narratives are battling it out on social media, a court session was held in Moscow with four apprehended suspects. And even seasoned Russia hands were taken aback by their appearance.
This was the first time I have seen such gruesome images emerging, showing either the moment that you can see person being tortured, or just straight afterwards. And even the pictures from the courtroom that we saw of the four suspects, you could tell that from the video that we verified when they were arrested, some of them were roughed up already or injured. But there were clear signs that had been even more beaten up in between, and one of them even had a plastic bag around their neck. For anyone who watches Russia, and lots of human rights activists have been for years saying that plastic bags are used sometimes in police custody for torture. But this is the first time I've personally seen remnants of a plastic bag just on a person who's been arrested. And I think that the fact that there was clear and consistent visual evidence of injuries and signs of torture on the suspects shocked quite a few Russia watchers.
When those horrible videos were published online, and some commentators say that they were deliberately published by the Russian security forces, it was very, very graphic and very, very, very horrible. But they gained a lot of press from pro-war commentators, from pro-Kremlin commentators. They said, "This, let everybody see what will happen to you if you do such a horrible act against Russia's people." And there were some, they called in Russia, liberal opposition voices, mainly from abroad, saying that this is a new law for Russia.
The Islamic State group started its messaging with glee that it managed to pull off a large-scale attack in Russia. But the pictures of the tortured suspects in the courtroom might have thrown a spanner in the jihadist propaganda works.
After these images went public of the torture, it really dims and dampens IS's ability to push that propaganda, because now everyone has seen those images of humiliation and defeat, being in distress. So this could hamper the group's ability to recruit.
The fact that the visuals were leaked onto various social media channels in a very consistent fashion was something completely new. And we don't even know whether it was deliberately leaked or whether it was as an order from above or whether it was just a personal initiative of the people doing the torture or that took part in the apprehension of the suspects. So we don't know what the exact motivation is, but it does leave quite a chilling effect.
It's been well known that this kind of torture does happen. But leaking the graphic images of the brutality, this is very unusual, isn't it?
It is really very unusual. And you can see that the people that were interrogated, and they're on their knees with their hands tied behind their backs. You can see that they were beaten up and bruised quite heavily. I want to quote an independent journalist, Ilya Rozhdestvensky. He told exiled Dosh TV that the footage that we're just talking about indicates a real big degradation of the entire intelligence system in Russia. And they have tortured people before, he said, but at least they tried to hide it somehow. And now it has become a new social norm. There's a huge number of posts that approve of this torture.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. Thanks to our contributors Andrei Vladov, Olga Robinson, Mina Al-Lami, Maruv Jonismatov, and Margarita Baliukova. This is all from the Global Jigsaw team, Krista Shattery and me, Krassi Twig. Our sound engineer is Graham Puddyfoot and our editor is Judy King. Thank you for giving us your time. Please let us know what you think at the Global Jigsaw, all one word, at bbc.co.uk.